Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we are joined by writer-director Jeffrey Nachmanoff, whose new film, Traitor, opens in theaters today. Also, director Fred Ashman will discuss his September release titled Proud American, and filmmakers Andre Fiedek and Torsten Grud will discuss their new documentary, Yodok Stories. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Everybody, this is Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie.
My name is Jerry.
And we are happy to bring you the show this evening. A trio of great filmmakers on the show tonight, and this is what it's all about. I'm really looking forward to tonight's show. Just to remind people out there, there is a chat room that you can converse with other movie geeks about any topic you'd like. Our first guest, his film is Traitor, and I don't know if you've had a chance to see. Jerry, you saw this today.
Yes, I did see it. It's a very good movie. I would recommend it to everyone this weekend.
Oh yeah. So start selling that big time in the chat room in there.
Okay. All right.
And you could also call if you have any questions of our guests. The number to dial is 718-508-9477. Got a big show tonight, so let's get started, huh?
Let's do it.
Okay, the new film Traitor, starring Don Cheadle and Guy Pearce, opens in theaters today. As we mentioned, this fantastically exciting and thought-provoking film was written and directed by our first guest tonight, Mr. Jeffrey Nachmanoff. Mr. Nachmanoff, who previously wrote the screenplay for the global warming adventure film The Day After Tomorrow, effortlessly weaves an intensely observant portrait of the roots and inner workings of terrorism and delivers the jaw-dropping visceral thrills that epitomize the best films of the suspense genre. We are very pleased tonight to welcome Mr. Jeffrey Nachmanoff to Movie Geeks United. Let's see if I can bring up his line here. Mr. Nachmanoff, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Yes, sir. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's good to be here.
We really enjoyed your film. It's a terrific pleasure to be able to speak to you about it. I'm wondering first, I read in an interview where you said that you look upon Traitor as really your first film as a director, even though that's not technically true. Why do you consider it your first film?
Well, it's my first film from my own screenplay. I went to film school and I did short films there, so those obviously were films, but this is the first film that I got to really kind of sit in the chair and do, really kind of control the process. I've worked as a, when I came out of film school, I did a feature-length film that I directed, but it was pretty low budget, and it wasn't from my own screenplay. So it was a great learning experience, but that's, it's a little different. It's not really my film. And then, I wrote the screenplay or co-wrote it for Day After Tomorrow with the director, and obviously right. I was serving his vision to a certain extent while I was working with him. And, in this case, I got to write the screenplay, and I was lucky enough to get an opportunity to actually direct my own screenplay. So I think that's why I kind of feel like this is the first one that's truly, the way I intended it to be.
Sure. Do you recall, I'm sure you do, who were your early filmmaking influences and what inspired you to get into the business in the first place?
Well, that's sort of a bit of a fraud being on moviegeeks.com because I was not a movie geek growing up. I discovered movies a little bit later and then became something of a movie geek. But it wasn't until I really was out of college, and I really got interested in the idea of movies and applied to film school, and then I sort of started trying to catch up with everybody else. I was really influenced by pretty wide variety of things. I remember always loving, you know, the Woody Allen films, frankly, on the more, you know, on the comedy side, and the Hitchcock films on the suspense side. And then as I started watching films, you know, in my contemporaries or the people who were making films when I was, by the time I moved to Los Angeles, I was really impressed with the work of people like Paul Greengrass, who's you know, making films now that I think are really exciting.
Right.
You know, Christopher Nolan, I've seen all of his films and, you know, big fan of his work. The people that you admire and the films that you admire kind of shift depending on what you're thinking about, too. When I was making this movie, which is sort of a suspense, old-fashioned espionage adventure movie, I really referred back to a lot of those great 70s films, like 3 Days of the Condor, All the President's Men, and you know, even Parallax View, that were really, they were French Connection, of course, political yet entertaining movies at the same time, and that was a genre that I really loved and seemed to have kind of faded a bit, and I'm hopeful that it can come back.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up, first of all, the 70s films, and then filmmakers like Greengrass and Nolan, because what I find unique in your work is the same as what I find unique in theirs, is that you seem to be able to weave in these real-world issues into, you know, essentially genre films.
Right.
When did you begin to realize that was kind of your sensibility, or is it?
No, I think that's an excellent observation. I think I realized it after I'd written, you know, I'd responded to genre films in the past, mostly, I would say, political thrillers and noirs. My first script that I had sold was in sort of a neo-noir, and it didn't get produced, but it kind of got me introduced to people. And then when I got the opportunity to work on Day After Tomorrow, once again, to be honest, I was at first a little taken aback. I didn't know disaster movies. I didn't even really know the director, Roland Emmerich's work very well. And I kind of went out and crammed over a weekend before I met with him and watched Poseidon Adventure and, you know, Independence Day, and, you know, just tried to get ready to sit down and talk with him. And when we ended up having a really good relationship and a good creative partnership, and I think maybe what I brought to the table there was he really understands how to make big popcorn action movies, and he really understands that type of storytelling. And I kind of brought a little bit of my political sensibility to it, and we ended up making a film which is, you know, pretty political and subversive. It's hard to remember now because things have changed so much, but at the time, I mean, I remember when we pitched it to the studio, that, you know, we were having meetings, and everyone says, well, you know, global warming's a big, you know, that's just made up, obviously, for Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's come a long way where people see it as a real problem, but at the time, it added a number of sort of political layers very, very lightly into a pure genre movie. You know, I mean, it's a pure genre action disaster movie, yet...
Sure.
You know, we also have, you know, a pretty strong parody of Vice President Cheney in the movie.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
And I loved putting that stuff in there, and to me, that's what made it more fun than your average movie.
Right.
So I think I realized that there's a way to make entertainment that also lets you grapple with the issues of the day, and hopefully a way that's just thought provoking and gets people talking when they leave the theater, which, you know, Traitor is kind of a new model for that, in the sense that it's a, you know, somewhere between The Bourne Identity and Syriana. You know,
that's a good point. That you're absolutely right. I also think what your film, the biggest strength that I really enjoyed, I saw it this afternoon, is that you're able to make this very entertaining political thriller, and you don't preach. You don't hit us over the head with anything, and it's done very well. You balanced it all very well. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah, and
I think it's important not to preach too much. You know, when you do preach too much, you get into a realm where only the people that agree with you are going to go see that movie. And
right.
I didn't want, you know, I kind of feel like this movie, I guess, I don't know whether this is good or bad, but I've been criticized from people who are sort of right wing and criticized from people who are left wing, you know, and likewise, some people on either side of it really respond to it. So the fact that it's both pissing people off on both sides and entertaining people on both sides, to me, is a good sign, because it means we put it out there, and I obviously have a political point of view, but I try and bury it enough and say, well, we're going to put a piece of entertainment out there first and foremost, and then layer in some other things and let people argue about it when they get out of the theater, hopefully.
Well, that's just it. I think that's a major strength of the film in that, obviously, it's very insightful. It has a point of view, but it raises some difficult questions that it leaves you to answer because, is there a right answer for some of these questions?
Right.
I mean, that's the dilemma we find ourselves in. Now, tell us a little bit about the story of Traitor for our audience who hasn't seen anything from it.
Sure. The character played by Don Cheadle is a Muslim man. His name is Samir Horn, and he's a former special ops figure who's, got some shady connections. We first meet him in Yemen, and he's dealing with a sort of a terrorist cell there and selling them explosives. And there's a raid, and he gets captured, and we see that there's an FBI agent named Roy Clayton on his tail, and that's played by Guy Pearce. And Guy Pearce has a partner played by Neil McDonough who's kind of a little bit more of a tough guy. But Guy Pearce's character is trying to figure out what's really going on. As the movie goes along, and he, meaning Don Cheadle's character, gets sucked deeper and deeper into the organization, we're not really clear on where his loyalties lie, whether he's, working for, which side he might be working for, and what he really believes. And Guy Pearce is trying to track him down and stop him before there can be any more terrorist attacks.
Right. I definitely want to ask you about Don Cheadle, but getting back to the formation of this film, I know you get asked this all the time, but for those of you out in the audience, the two of you that don't know, Steve Martin, this is based on an idea that Steve Martin came up with and pitched. Did you collaborate closely with him in the development of this idea into a screenplay?
It would be, I wish I could say I collaborated closely. We met, he came up with the original idea, wrote it up as a treatment, which for those of you who are listening is sort of like a short story about five to 10 pages long that kind of summarizes the idea. And the producers bought that, and then they said, well, we need we want to turn this into a full-fledged movie, and they brought me on board to do that as a screenwriter. And at that time, I was not seen as a director for the project. I was just just there to write the screenplay. So I sat down with Steve, I pitched him my ideas, and he gave me his blessing, and I went off and started, reading books about this subject for 6 months, and then eventually turned in the screenplay, and he read it, was finished, and once again, he liked it, so that which was gratifying. I mean, look, Steve Martin's a towering figure, and I was kind of excited. I was actually just excited to get a chance to meet him.
Yeah.
And then he was great. When it was finished, I showed it to him, and he was really pleased. I think a lot of his initial ideas is represented in the final movie.
And tell me those ideas through that treatment or through your research that sparked your imagination and your enthusiasm for this project. What were you most excited about?
Well, you guys have seen, not all of your viewers have seen it yet, so I don't want to get, and there's a couple of twists in the movie that are pretty fun, and it's the irritating thing about both marketing and reviewers is they sometimes give away too much. If you're the filmmaker, you want people just to go in and see it.
You know what? I was going to ask you about the trailer, so I think you just answered the...
It's a business. You guys know how it works. All your fans out there know how. And the funny thing is, I could argue it's one blue in the face, and I remember seeing, when you go on some of the fan sites, they're like, why do they give this away in the trailer? But, the reality is that you have to show the fans enough to get them to go see it. And although I was initially uncomfortable with that, now that I've seen enough people that saw it after seeing the trailers, and you guys can weigh on this because you had that experience, I kind of feel like it still has enough surprises that the trailers don't really spoil it, I don't know. Do you guys think so? Or?
I absolutely do think so. I think there's three or four just jaw-dropping moments in this film that really got a vocal reaction from the crowd. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, I went into the movie cold. I knew the performers in it, so it was a complete discovery for me, and just a fantastic piece of work. And I really congratulate you on it, Jerry. And I
say in my history as a film watcher, I don't think I've ever had as much pure enjoyment of a film as the times when I've walked in cold. Film like I'm a huge fan of. We're talking about Chris's film, Dark Knight. But because I was working on the sort of finishing and promotion for this movie, I didn't get to see it until like a week ago. And I'd heard so much about it. It was still fun, but I know I would have enjoyed it a lot more had I not heard everybody and his brother, trying to tell me what to think about it.
Right.
In some ways, I just feel like this is why I just wish I could just black out all everyone else's opinion on every movie you ever go see. There's nothing as pure as going to see a movie for yourself and deciding for yourself what you you know, what you respond to and what you like, even when you don't know who's going to be in it. You know, that's great, too.
That is.
Yeah, you're right. We've lost that culture completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what? Thanks to the Internet.
Well, you know what? The Internet has wonderful qualities, but then there's other things about it. You're absolutely right. What happens now is we can't help ourselves but know too much. And we do ourselves a little bit of a disservice because we've taken away some of the pleasure. You know, we've taken away the ability to really be surprised. I mean, it used to be a long time ago. I don't even know. I'm supposing that people literally, and maybe some people still do, they just go to their local multiplex saying, "We're going to the movies tonight," not even knowing what they're going to see. And they would literally just go to whatever movie was showing.
Right.
And imagine how different that experience was for them. The first time you see a Kubrick film, you know, the first time you see, the original Hitchcock films. And my director of photography, Jimmy Murrow, who did a great job on this film, and he said to me the other day after we'd watched it, he said, you know, one day in like 10 years, someone's just going to walk up to someone with a disc of this movie and say, "Pop that in your DVD player, you're in for a fun surprise." And, that thought kind of tickled me, because it's true. Once everything dies down and people, you know, it's seen, it's forgotten, it's remembered, there is a way to experience something fresh again, and that is the great thing about some DVDs, is, you know, people can literally recommend a film that you know nothing about, and if you can resist looking up on the Internet, you can still have that pure experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely... tell me something. You got a huge opportunity with Day After Tomorrow. You somehow convinced them to allow you, thankfully so, to direct your screenplay for this film, Traitor. How did you do that? How did those opportunities come about?
For all the fans out in the audience who are aspiring screenwriters, well, right. The writing part of it came from being open to different, open to, you know, I should say I learned a lesson. I'd been writing for eight years, I think, out of film school, and I'd had a decent career. I earned some money, and I was reasonably well respected, but I hadn't had a movie produced. And the opportunity for Day After Tomorrow came along, and, you know, a part of me was a little bit film snobby about it. It was like, disaster movie? That's not my genre. I'm too good to do that, you know? And I ended up going in and meeting Roland Emmerich and being really impressed with him, and ended up embracing it and saying, you know, never mind what kind of movie. If there's going to be a disaster movie, my job is to come in and write the best disaster movie, you know, the smartest, the most politically, you know, it depends what you set the bar. I said, I'm not going to write whatever, you know, the Towering Inferno 2. I'm going to write a movie that takes on global warming, entertains people, fulfills the genre, and gives this director a script that he really wants to shoot. And when you set your goal like that and you embrace it, it can be actually really rewarding and fun. And as a result, obviously the movie had a lot of commercial success, and that opened some more doors for me. I wrote this script, and the script was well received. I wrote it in 2004, I think, but the studio was afraid to make a film about a touchy political subject, so it sat on the shelf. And eventually I kind of came back to the producers and said, look, this film's not going to get made as a huge studio film, but for a medium budget, I think we could go out and make this. And by the way, if you're going to do it that way, which, you know what you really need? You need a writer-director to do that. So let's find one. Oh, perfect. Why don't we use me? And, you know, I just kind of talked my way into that consideration. And then, you know, I was able to meet Don Cheadle and kind of get along with him. And that really pushed everyone over the edge when they saw that I could work with an actor of that caliber that allayed a few fears. And frankly, they took a chance. It's always a chance whenever you agree to let someone make their first big movie.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the process of getting Day After Tomorrow, and I have to ask, I asked this of a previous guest once. It fascinates me. There's a certain discipline to pitching a movie as well, I would think.
Yeah.
And, you know, artists have to be salesmen as well, and those seem like two opposing personalities. Did you find that a difficult transition?
I think that the people, you know, I went to film school with some people who were extremely talented, and many of those people I think were maybe more talented than I am, to be honest. But if they didn't have the ability to also be salesmen, they are not they didn't end up working in film. So me, I tried to learn, you know, yes, I've become a better salesman than I was when I started, but those were muscles I had to learn to exercise, so to speak. And they became really important because, you know, directing is another challenge different from writing. You know, you're still telling a story, but a lot of your challenges are interpersonal. It's convincing your actors to do it the way you want them to do it, leading a team of people, talking to and communicating with all of the key crew members. All of those things are sort of managerial skills, frankly. And not everybody who's a great writer or even a great visionary, let's say someone who has all the ideas but can't communicate them, they're not going to have a very easy time making a movie as a director. So
right.
You do have to be, you know, it's a learning curve. You know, you have to learn every day you make a mistake, and hopefully you don't make that same mistake the next day.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
You make a different one.
It's an ongoing cycle, and then you learn
it's
from that one.
Cycle, yeah.
Yeah, you have a fantastic cast in this movie. Guy Pearce and Neil McDonough and Jeff Daniels, just on and on and on. But I want to know about Don Cheadle. Yeah, I want to know about Don Cheadle. This is I think, a very risky role, and he's so fantastic in this film. Tell me about his process and what he wants from a director, what he needs from you as a director.
Well, Don's an extremely smart guy. He knows filmmaking inside and out, and he's in this case he became a producer on the film as well. So he was really a partner, you know. And I learned from him, and I think he maybe learned some things from me as well. But it was definitely a two-way street. And I feel like Don's attitude, which I agree with, is, you know, no guts, no glory. This is a film that, you know, we could have gone down in flames on. Where it's, by the way, that's on every level, even on the production level. We were walking a tightrope. We shot in, four different countries on multiple continents, various time zones on a budget that's a small fraction of the budget you might have for a, you know, similar, comparable studio movie.
Right.
And we couldn't afford to make mistakes. We really had to just, you know, barrel through whenever we had trouble with schedule or, you know, any of the things that happen on a movie. It rains, you just have to kind of be agile and say, okay, we're going to do something else today. Don's a very daring actor that way, and I think he took this part on. He really embraced it. He wanted to learn and understand as much as he could. I'd obviously done quite a bit of research. He picked up where I left off and kept doing more. You know, when he got inside this character, inside the world of Islam, inside the beliefs of the people that he was, the character he's portraying, and he just, you know, I can't say enough about him. He does such tremendously wonderful, detailed work, and he gives you so many options as a director. The only thing, I guess, to answer your question on what he demands of a director is an equal sense of perfectionism, someone who's equally committed to what they are doing, or he or she is doing. You know, you cannot come to an actor like Don Cheadle with lazy ideas or lazy directions.
Right.
You better know what you're talking about, and you know, you better be on your A game, because he always is.
Yeah, it's such a fantastic performance, and it's so delicate, because he just with the slightest facial gesture, he has to convey, you know, both kind of sides of the coin that he has to play here. So,
yeah, he's a very subtle actor. He knows himself very well. He's very comfortable in front of the camera, and he doesn't need a lot of takes. You know, we often, and I didn't like to do, as you know, 100 takes. So with Don, there might be, you know, 2 or 3 takes. And as the editor would say, but he gives you 2 or 3 magical choices when he, in each take, he does something different.
What do you hope that audiences get from this? Obviously, this is in theaters everywhere. I don't know, have you sat in with a regular audience yet?
I've sat in on, you know, a couple of preview audiences and screenings. I haven't gone to the, you know, the theater to see it, but I've heard it play with a regular audience, so to speak. That is not the preview, not the premiere audience, you know. And it's really fascinating, because the response, and it's, once again, you have to see it to know. But there, some audiences respond verbally, really loudly, to certain things in the movie. There are a couple of big reversals and reveals, and there are moments of, I don't know if you found this, but there are moments of kind of, I would call them tension release humor. It's really interesting. The first time I saw it with an audience and I heard laughter, I was a little bit afraid. I thought, oh my God, they're laughing. They're completely out of the movie, you know? And I only realized after, as it went on and they were laughing at the sort of what I call the right places, that it was a response to what they were seeing on screen. And it really depends on the audience. You know, some people are terrified by the movie, Younger crowds really take it more as a ride, I think. But I hope that people can, you know, when you make a movie, you can't control how people are going to respond to it. You know, there's a great line from the book Jarhead where he says, which is about Marines, and the character in it says, you know, they used to show us movies like Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket, which were made as, you know, these anti-war films to try and convince you the war is bad and show the horrors of war. And he said, for a Marine, there's no such thing as an anti-war film. They're just war films. They cheer. They love them all.
Right.
They take them all as advertisement for war. So, you know, you put a film out there and people are going to take it and they're going to respond to it however it fits their worldview. The audience brings a lot into the theater, and you have to kind of just go with that.
Obviously, the audiences are going to leave entertained because this is, first and foremost, a really entertaining ride, this film. But what, if in the best of worlds, would you want them to leave thinking about after
thinking about
film?
Talking about? Well, you know, this is I think that the issue of radical Islam and the terrorism that we've seen post 9/11 and the Western response to it and counterterrorism is something it's a very difficult and complex thing to grapple with. It's not a black and white issue. There's a lot of gray. There's gray. Not that there's gray when you talk about the heinous acts of terrorism, whether they're good or bad, but there's gray in terms of how far are we willing to go in order to stop the enemy? What civil liberties are we willing to sacrifice? What acts are we going to condone to try and pursue the terrorists? So on the other hand, what is driving this? I mean, to me, it's an interesting and important question to try and get inside the heads of the people who are tempted to participate in these groups. Not to say that the leaders are anything less than sort of evil, but not everybody is a mastermind. And, you know, the main character, Omar, is a character that I hope people find not necessarily sympathetic, although some audiences seem to, just someone that they can relate to. And they, you know, he's someone who's got beliefs, although they may not be ones we agree with, that we can at least come to understand. And I'd love it if people come out of the theater discussing these things and arguing about them. And, you know, people have, and I hear it, I've heard it after some of the screenings, some people think that the point is A, and some people think the point is B. But then pretty soon it should not be a discussion in a perfect world about what the movie's point is. It's what's your point? What do you think?
Yeah.
Right, you know?
Yeah, and that's the magic of films. It when it's done well, like this one is, it allows you to empathize with characters that you normally wouldn't.
It puts you in a new place. You know, I was a big fan of the Constant Gardner, the Fernando Mireles film based on the John Le Carré book, which is, you know, tries to do some. I mean, I think we're trying to do some of the same things. It's a John Le Carré thriller.
Mm-hmm.
In time. It begs a number of questions about the political realities of the world we live in. You know, and in that movie, they're talking about what's it like for, you know, what are white people doing in Africa? You know, are they helping the situation? Are they meddling? Are they, you know, and the pharmaceuticals there? I mean, you know, there's old fashioned conspiracy stuff and bad guys and good guys, but there's also gray areas. And I love that in a movie. To me, it makes a movie more than just a night out, because it gives you one extra little bump of entertainment and starting off of a discussion.
Yeah. I have to ask you this before you leave. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be celebrating the art of film composition, film composing, and we're working on scheduling Mark Killian, who is your composer for this film. Tell me about the process of working with him.
Yeah, Mark Killian was terrific. I went off and I shot the movie and I came back and I put together the very first rough of it and I started meeting with composers. There were some really talented people out there and I was incredibly flattered that they came and met with me. You know, these are people that have done 50, 100 films, I don't know. And Mark was someone I'd heard literally a music to a soundtrack to a movie called Before the Rains, which is a small film. And it was being played when I was watching dailies. Someone put the disc in while we were watching the dailies one day. And I just said, whose music is that? It just fits so well with the, you know, with what we're looking at. And they said, it's this guy, Mark Killian. And he doesn't have a huge amount of, you know, films under his belt. But I met with him and immediately realized that this guy just got this film. And he has a really organic way of working. He'll ask him when he comes on your show ask him, but we went up to, you know, he composed it. We used a lot of African and Middle Eastern instruments, but also we used some very synthetic and really, he uses a lot of really creative instruments like, you know, found objects and metal and, you know, car jacks and springs and all sorts of things to build the soundtrack. But we went to Seattle to score it. And there's this one moment, I can't forget, we're on the scoring stage. He's got something like 50 string players in front of him, and he's conducting sort of in a 360 arc, like waving his arms around, just getting them to play notes that are not normally possible on the violin and the viola. and I took like a little teeny video of it. It's pretty amazing. But he's like that. He just is so creative, and he takes chances, and gives you something really fresh. And I love the soundtrack that we have for the movie.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Do you have anything brewing, or are you just sitting back and enjoying this experience?
I'm just kind of decompressing from this experience, but looking around, you know, I'm interested in, you know, I would love to find something that's also, you know, my interests haven't really changed. I like political stuff, but I also like sci-fi stuff, and I think that there's probably something out there that I'm just playing around with in my head that will probably develop into a screenplay, but it hasn't really formed completely yet.
Well, keep us posted. We're crazy about your movie, and please come back to us anytime you'd like.
It was a pleasure talking with you guys.
You too. Thanks so much.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye now. The movie is called Traitor. It is in theaters starting today. Jerry and I highly recommend it.
Definitely.
And what more do you need? What more do you need when you have mine and Jerry's recommendation?
Yeah, when you have that, I mean, really just go out now. Listen to the rest of the show, then go out.
Yeah,
or go first thing in the morning. Or go first thing in the morning.
Yes. Yes. A very good film, a very accomplished film. Jerry, I'm having problems with my switchboard. It keeps going down, so I'm keeping...
My computer shut down. I had to reboot my computer.
I wonder if we have a virus. Are we sharing the same virus?
I don't know. Uh-oh.
Project.
Oh, no.
Just to let our guests know, if they are on the line, our next guest... I'm just having to reboot our switchboard. We're working with antiquated computer technology on this show.
I think everyone's getting booted off. Jason came back in the chat room, so...
Yeah, for those of you that are listening live and are not logged into our chat room, please do so. It's a great amount of fun. There's lots of movie geeks hang out in there, and you'll have a great time if you're one of them, conversing back and forth. My switchboard...
Heading out to see Traitor right now.
I figures he'd miss most of our show.
Well, he's going to see Traitor. Hopefully, he's going to. Yeah, I came from Movie Geeks. Told me to see it.
Yeah, he's got a good excuse.
He's got a very good excuse.
Okay, I believe our next guest is on the line, and we're very excited about this. Fred Ashman is here. He's the writer, co-producer, and director of a new film titled Proud American, which opens in theaters on IMAX screens starting in September. The film is a celebration of the best of our country and those who overcome overwhelming obstacles to realize their version of the American dream. And if my switchboard is working, I believe we have a trailer for this film. So let's test this. Let's see if it's working.
Okay.
America comes alive as you've never seen it before. Shot in 70mm, the vast beauty of the American landscape is the backdrop for five stories of challenge, determination, and courage.
Man, Curtis, man, you ain't no fun.
A kid from one of the toughest neighborhoods in Chicago struggles with choices and his dream to be a doctor.
Try it out.
University and med school? It's a dream for people like us.
You told me that you wanted to be a doctor since you were 10 years old.
I'm so glad we've worked that all out.
A girl's story of survival and transition. From an overloaded boat without food or water, to the pain of a young teen dealing with a new culture and language.
Like, Dawn, this is our table. You have to leave. So, like, hit the road. Yeah, don't you have a boat to catch?
To becoming an American success story.
We're going to show them how philosophy does business.
Blind hatred invades a suburban community.
Merry Christmas!
Sarah, call 911.
Forcing the neighbors to face a test of integrity
who can do
they never imagined.
Hog sensors.
A young man,
I'm done.
Paralyzed, struggles to recover his life.
This is to remind you who you are. You are a Navy SEAL.
From the depths of despair to the heights of achievement. Proud American. A film about freedom, opportunity, and responsibility. A different kind of film about the best of the American experience. There are many reasons to be a proud American. Coming to theaters this September, also in IMAX at selected locations.
Please welcome to the show Mr. Fred Ashman. Mr. Ashman, okay. Are you with us?
I'm with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's great to be able to speak with you. Give me a little sense right off the bat, that's how we usually start the conversations, about your history in filmmaking. When did you first realize that filmmaking was for you, and who are your influences to push you in that direction?
Well, I actually had a written goal to be a professional musician, a pilot, an audio technician of all things, and a television director when I was 13.
Wow, and you're ambitious.
And I've done all of them.
Oh, and goodness.
And I had my own band at Disneyland when I was 18, and we were playing rock music at the time. And then I've got 4,000 hours in my own plane, and I've been directing film, video, and TV, but mostly outside of Hollywood. Since I was about 23. And I've had my own production company. We do very, very large corporate work, including IMAX films and other things, and a lot of, some documentaries, but very, very large, both live events combined with big video and film with some pretty substantial budgets. And then I did two of the giant screen films for the American Airlines Museum in Dallas, and I've done a lot of work for American through the years. And that's what got me in the direction of actually making this film. And after 9/11 and such, and the aftermath of that, and just watching what's going on in the world, I said, people are starting to forget about the core of what binds us together as Americans. We hear what's wrong and what separates us every single day. So I set out researching to find some really, really cool stories about sort of the reluctant hero, average people who did extraordinary things. And of all places, the Reader's Digest has a ton of those stories. They opened their entire library to me for free.
Yeah, wow.
And I started coming up with a concept. And then it sat there because I was busy doing my other work, and we did a couple of big documentaries and things. And years went by, and then I started to get serious about it. And it took me 5 years to raise the money. From first concept, it's been 15 years, and now it's done, and it's going to be released nationally on September 12th.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you talked about you had a laundry list of things that you wanted to accomplish, and you've been able to accomplish them all, and that's part of the American dream right there. And so I applaud you for making this film. What kinds of stories and characters were you looking for when you're researching?
I was looking for people that other people could relate to, not somebody that does some, absolutely phenomenal thing. I want people who face everyday circumstances, and when most of them would just say, "What the heck with it? I'm just not going to try to do that. That's going to be too hard," and they persevere, and then they get slapped down again, and they came back. So we found these real stories about real people, and I did a screenplay around them because I wanted them to be dramatic, not a documentary. We're technically a docudrama, but the other thing I wanted to do was I started out to make this as an IMAX film, strictly an IMAX film. So it was going to be little stories with big pictures of the country and kind of what you would expect, but with a bonus of some good stories in it. And as we got into it, the people from Regal Cinemas said, "Fred, you've got to make this into a 35. This will be a great story. It'll play." And so I ended up making it a 35, and I started looking at full length, and we ended up with a screenplay. It's an hour and 45 minutes, and then a bunch of people in the IMAX world says, "We can't run this in 45 minutes against an hour and 45-minute film, so you've got to make them both the same length. So we did.
Okay, so it's partly 35, partly IMAX.
Right. What we did was we took if you go to IMAX films like Dark Knight, which is really cool and really cool in IMAX. Those scenes where they did the full IMAX, they're cool, but because you're seeing a Hollywood movie side to side, there's something about film literacy that, you know, that just the impact of the giant screen, full screen images isn't nearly as dramatic as it might be. Because if you watch the usual IMAX fare, it's the big, you know, the big beautiful scenes, and it's slowly cut, and you get really into the vision of it, the visual. And what I want to do was to have those moments and not destroy them by taking everybody into action that is too big and too close. So what we did is we letterboxed the dramatic stories.
Okay.
And it's still big. It's about the size of a normal big screen, like a stadium theater, on the IMAX screen. But at the end of each one of those, at the open, the close, and in between each one, there's these big sequences. And one of the stories is told completely in IMAX, where it just opens up. And it's like if you were watching a stage play. You know, sometimes they'll have it kind of intimate and something's happening, and then all of a sudden it opens to the right and the left, and then the top goes up. And of course, if you're in Vegas and it's a Cirque du Soleil, the bottom goes out and something else comes in. But it expands your horizon tremendously. And we did some experiments with it, and I showed it to a bunch of the theater chains, and they went, oh, my God, it just works great. Mm. So that's what we did with these. And it completely changed the impact. And it was actually I got the Cinemark chain on board before we ever had a distributor, and I've never taken it to a festival yet.
Oh wow! So tell me about the different formats. Are there different challenges in working with a larger film format than 35?
Yeah, it's extraordinarily expensive, cumbersome, and a pain in the butt. But it's pretty.
Yeah. I guess that was an obvious question.
No, but it's real, real hard to shoot sync sound with it because the thing sounds like a giant coffee grinder going off.
Oh, really?
There aren't any blimped cameras.
Oh.
So if you're doing sound with it, you're either looping everything or you're putting it way in the back of the room with a longer lens or something, and I got to put some furniture burning pads around it to quiet it down a little bit.
So what are some of these, in the larger format sections, what are some of these parts of America that we're going to see in this film?
We went to 140 locations,
mm.
and we went by Learjet, helicopter, and on the ground, and from Boston to Hawaii and all around the country. We're not trying to do a travelogue of the country, but we see a lot of it in these sections. And I should send you a screener because it's a very difficult film to describe. Each story sets up what I call a sequence. We continue the story in the giant screen format with generally a piece of music or something else that happens in the giant format. And sometimes it's a little bit of additional story, but it supports and links with the dramatic story you just saw.
Yeah.
And it's very, very hard to describe. I mean, even the theater chains and Cinemark actually bought it and committed to the film after seeing 17 minutes of it because it wasn't done yet. And all the other chains have just now seen it in the last 2 weeks and committed to it. We're in somewhere between 600 and 800 screens right now. I haven't talked to the distributor lately. But it's been interesting because only within the last 14 days has anybody seen the film. The whole thing. And the senior film buyers in every case have said, oh, my gosh, this is so much better than I thought it was going to be, which did make me feel pretty good.
Yeah.
And these had the president of one of the film chains and one of the senior film buyers, his chief film buyer, come to me afterwards and says, we don't get emotional in movies, Fred. We cried twice.
Well, that's good.
Been great. It's a very different kind of thing, and I set out to make people laugh a little bit, to make them emotional and really touch the emotions. We've done that. And then to have them walk out feeling just positive in rekindling all that stuff that we take for granted. And a lot of this came out of interviews that I did when I was researching this. I sat in the back of a taxi in New York, and this young black guy was just smiling ear to ear, and he's so happy. And I said, "Wow, what are you so happy about?" He says, "Why? I'm in America." And I, you know, I'm thinking, "Oh, right." And he says, "Yes." I said, "Oh, yeah, so?" And he says, "You don't understand. My daughter can go to school." I said, "Yeah. Oh, yeah?" And he says, "For free." And I said, "Well, that's what happens here." And he says, "But you don't understand. We don't worry about someone coming in the night to kill us."
Yeah.
And it started to make sense. And then the more immigrants I talked to, the more I said, found out that, oh, my gosh, we take everything for granted.
Mm.
So I set out to kind of expose all of us to saying, you know, stop and smell the roses. And, yeah, we got things to correct, and we're not perfect. But this is a pretty damn good country. Why else would we have to put up fences to keep people out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that your film is definitely needed. I mean, like you said, we hear a lot about what problems plague America, and I think that's important. But there needs to be a balance where we can also appreciate the best of who we are and what we are as a country. And your film certainly does that. Tell me, I'm sure you had a laundry list of different types of stories that you wanted to tell. Tell me about the process of cutting those down to the few that you use in this film.
I wanted one that kind of depicted this, you know, not a rags to riches so much as a rags to pretty neat success and be able to retire, a small business story.
Yeah.
And I found a wonderful story about a lady who came from Vietnam. And it was interesting in casting for it. Jane Lee plays the lead, and she was tremendous. She plays from a 17-year-old teenager right on through to, late 20s, early 30s when we leave her. And when she read for the part, there's a part where Mackenzie Rossman, who was Ruthie on Seventh Heaven, plays the mean girl in high school. Ruthie's kind of grown up now. And she always had played a goody-goody, and she asked me if she could play this role of the mean girl, and she did. And in it, they're really, it's kind of almost a bullying scene. And when Jane read it, she stopped reading in the audition and started to sob.
Mm.
And I went over, "Jane, are you okay? You know, what's going on?" And she said, "You don't understand. This is the story of my mother, and to a great extent, I lived it as well."
Wow.
And we started, I knew then that the story was working. But she goes on and goes through the struggles and ends up getting married. And they, actually, she's sort of a business person and a dynamo, and she marries this computer guy. He's sort of a computer geek, but they end up starting their own little software company. And it's about their struggle. They just about go under, like many of them do. But they make it. They don't make it Bill Gates level make it. They make it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that, so that's one of the stories, and it sets up a really neat little vignette of about four little 30-second stories that are very cool on the giant screen, and there's a couple of laughs in them, but it's all real. And that part, it suddenly turns to very much documentary-like, except you hear the real people talking about their little small business. Mm-hmm. And there's a neat setup to that works. Yakov Smirnoff, the comedian, is in it, and he comes at the open, and he appears twice more, real little tiny, you know, 10-second transitions. And he opens up with "Only in America," and he goes about all the stupid things we Americans do. And I have yet to see an audience that didn't absolutely laugh out loud. So, and it's got the only political statement in it at that point. And I won't tell you what it is, but I will tell you that I stand by the political statement, and it's an equal opportunity offender to all politicians. And everybody,
right,
left and right, has loved this.
That's good.
Well,
tell me about
the politics. Tell me, you know, obviously, if you're celebrating America as you are in this film, I mean, that's something separate from politics. But was it important for you to keep the film apolitical?
Both apolitical and non-religious.
Right.
We have a story that is almost the screenplay follows the story almost word for word out of the report from the Boston Globe years ago, and it was about a couple of skinheads go into a neighborhood, and there's Christmas lights on every single house except one, and it's got a menorah in the window and some blue lights. And they came in the middle of the night with a ball bat and smashed the window and take off screaming, you know, Merry Christmas. You heard that in the trailer.
Yeah.
And it's the story there is all about how the neighborhood responded. And depending on the person, we've had it, some people actually, when they see how the neighborhood actually did respond, I've had some people get some tears, just not tears of, oh, my God, kind of tears, but just, oh, my gosh, they really did that. And, yes, they did. That opens up into a sequence I call Freedom of Religion, and we got a really cool song that goes with it. And it shows just all sorts of different wonderful, wonderful shots in helicopter and down low and IMAX, all these different religions with a song that goes about, you know, Free to Believe, it's called. And Stan Beard is our composer and composes these incredible songs to go with it. And in Free to Believe, it's, you know, Free to Believe in this and that and this and that, and Free to Believe in nothing at all, and we're at an Elvis wedding. And and again, it's a little 2.5-3 minute piece that takes you to the next, and then we go to the next story and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's how it feels like, when I describe it, like it's patched work together, and everybody was very skeptical. And then when I've seen it, and my test has not been at the festival circuits, but it's been with some real audiences, and then the theater chain buyers and owners of the big theater chains.
Right.
And it's worked with all of them. So that's been, it's a very different film. I didn't pioneer techniques, but I put them together in a way that's never been done.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you open on a firehouse, a New York firehouse?
We were going to open on it, but it ended up being in the middle.
Okay.
And we did put an IMAX camera on the back of one of the big ladder trucks and go through the streets of New York. And that was a hoot.
Well, tell me, you know, your film begins to open the day after the 7-year anniversary, obviously, of 9/11. Tell me, in the time that you've spent with them, the firefighters, what the feeling is there in the firehouse after 9/11.
I think I could best describe it as respectful, somber, and they go about their business. They're professionals. And the pictures of the guys we shot at a firehouse, and I think they lost 7 or 8 guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the pictures are there in the little memorials, and they have names of the guys written on the trucks. We'll never forget. The guys were terrific. They, at first, were a little wary of what we were going to do, the old fire department was, because there's been so many things about exploitation of that. And
right.
I definitely didn't want to do that, and this film does not exploit that aspect of it at all. That little section has a tribute to, you know, our not only the New York public service people who were lost, but to all. It sets up another story. But it started out as an excuse to put an IMAX camera on a fire truck and go through the streets of New York. And then I interviewed a couple of, because I just wanted to always do that.
Yeah.
I mean, that just seemed like, that's the 10-year-old in me coming out. Let's go do that.
Absolutely,
and then,
yeah.
Then I interviewed a firefighter who gave me a couple of stories. He gave me several stories. And then the one we have in the film, which is the shortest story, it's about 2.5 minutes long, follows the firefighter scene, and it was really neat, and it works, and it doesn't exploit. Matter of fact, I have so there were some people who wanted me to open on 9/11, and I said no, I'll open after, but and I'll open that week, but I that's a sacred day, and we don't do that.
Yeah, I agree. The film is called Proud American. It opens September 12th in theaters and IMAX screens across the country. Is it a platform release, or is it opening wide on the 12th?
It's opening wide on the 12th.
Okay.
So we're pretty excited about it. I'm excited to be on your show, and We're a little movie. We financed this totally outside the theater system. I had to raise all the money totally outside.
And, you did, and I saw some of the how did the funding work? I saw the likes of several corporations that
put
the money.
Yeah, well, they're pretty big. Well, just imagine going in and saying, "Hey guys, I want you to give me seven figures. You don't get anything back if I get it done. There's no guarantee that I will make it good enough that it'll get distributed, but if it does, you'll get your name on it." And I got Coca-Cola, MasterCard, Walmart, and American Airlines to help me out on this thing.
That's as big
and,
as it gets, yeah.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, there was another 100 of them that showed me the door in short order.
Mm-hmm.
And in all every case, it was through personal connection at the very top of the company who finally they took the time to meet me, see what the concept was and see what I was going to do, and then look at the resume, because I got about 120 awards that we've won for our work, and I showed them some samples of other things, but showed them the pitch piece that said what this film's going to be, and they just said, "We've got to get involved in this, and we've got to help you make it happen."
Yeah. Well, it's an important film. It celebrates the best of our country, and I commend you, sir, for making it, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. September 12th, the film is called Proud American. Look for it. Mr. Ashman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just call me Fred, and you can call me anytime. And we do have a website, proudamericanfilm.com, and they can look at the trailers and see the cast and everything.
proudamericanfilm.com. Jerry, if you can type that
in
the chat room for our chatters
right
in there.
Now.
Yeah, and we would just love to, any feedback from people, you can write to us right through there. And I'll look at all of them. We're not a big company, so we'd love to see it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for allowing us to talk about your movie tonight.
Thank you for allowing me to be on your great show. I love it.
We look forward to talking to you sometime in the future, sir. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
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 That's Fred Ashman, director of Proud American. And my switchboard is gone again.
Oh, no, man. This is like... Oh, man.
What is going on? Like, it's giving me error messages?
It's a Wednesday night. It's the Wednesday night BTR curse. I mean...
Doesn't my computer know that I'm doing a radio show? It should be respectful of that.
It's got to know better.
All right. I'm going to have to reboot again.
Okay. they're all talking about, or we're talking about, Joe Biden talking... at the convention in the chat room. Well, they were.
They're not even listening to our show in the chat
room.
They're
not. No, they're not. They're not. The futurist is in there. All eyes are towards the futurist. So.
Yeah, it harkens back to our first guest tonight. I will call them all traitors.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Okay. I'm rebooting my computer. If
keep
our
your
next
fingers
guest
crossed, are... everyone, and, you know, all you people in the chat room, just please, like, feign interest, fake interest at least in what we're talking about, please.
If our next guests are already on the line, please sit tight. It's about 3 minutes till, so maybe they're not. I'm having to reboot my system to bring back up the switchboard. It's, you know, very antiquated technology. Later on, we're going to try to make fire in the show. I think that'll be fun.
There you go. Let's do it. Let's break out the fire.
Yeah, you got some stones I could rub together.
Yeah, I got some stones, and we can do all that. We can do all that. Hey, I don't know what. Olivia's having a party, and I'm not invited. Okay, that's fine. That's fine, Olivia. If you two can play at that game.
Are you gonna have an opposing party?
I'm gonna have an opposing party.
We're gonna have dueling
parties. We'll go up to Baltimore to the block or something, some strip joints or whatever.
You're going to have the JNC, the Jerry National Convention.
I'm going to have the Jerry National Convention, which I think is the last time I looked is all strippers and never mind. But,
Thank you. I'm sure it is.
strippers
okay.
And comic book artist model.
Okay. That's how we pass the time when we're having technical difficulties.
Yes, we just...
That's how we fill the time. Okay, I got it back up and our next guests are on the line. Okay, and this is a terrific movie, and I feel very honored to be able to expose it to all of our listeners out there tonight. It is estimated that between 200 and 300,000 people are imprisoned in North Korean concentration camps, where they are subjected to horrendous acts of torture and starvation. and a fortunate few manage to escape the vicious clutches of these camps and defect to South Korea, where they seek to build productive and meaningful lives. In the new documentary Yodok Stories, filmmakers Andre Fiedek and Torsten Grud follow some of these brave souls as they attempt to mount, of all things, a musical, through which they can convey the devastating culture of immoral imprisonment that has largely gone unrecognized by the outside world. The film just enjoyed a smashing series of screenings during DocuWeek in L.A., and it has garnered some really rave critical and audience responses across the board. And tonight we are honored to welcome the director and co-writer of the film, Mr. Andre Fiedek, and the film's producer and additional co-writer, Torsten Grud. And let me bring them back. Where's my switchboard? I'm getting tired of these technical issues. Okay, here they are. Let's see if they come up. Gentlemen, are you with us?
Yes, we are.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Having us.
I saw the film, and it's a breathtaking experience. So I can't wait to discuss it with you. But first of all, tell us a little bit about yourselves, how both of you broke into filmmaking and what inspired you to do so, starting with you, Mr. Fiedek.
So I'm the director of the film. I've been dealing with, I'm Polish. Mm-hmm. I'm dealing with documentary films for around 25 years. And,
wow.
And some 20 years ago, I made a documentary film called The Parade in North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And the film was pretty well known. And after many years, Torsten Grude, the producer, Norwegian producer of this film, approached me. It was just 4.5 years ago, and proposed to think about a new thing on North Korean issues, and that's how we began our cooperation. The film is now just very fresh, brand new one, and we've been working on it for 4.5 years.
Yes, sir. I definitely want to ask you about how the film, the gestation of the film, how it came about. Mr. Grud, how did you get into the producing realm of things?
Well, when I was a child, I was very much into like computer games and graphics,
mm-hmm.
and eventually I got into animation, and that led to a job in a TV channel, and then I became very much interested in documentary films.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 10 years, I've been producing and directing films.
Tell me from both of you what it is about documentary filmmaking as opposed to narrative, that is enticing to you, that attracts you. Mr. Grud, what is it about the documentary form?
Documentaries have always been, very interesting to me because it's about real issues, it's about real people. Also, you see the impact a film can have. I've noticed that on myself, that documentaries really affect me deeply when I see
right.
them. And also, I think we are making films most of the time on human rights issues.
Yes.
Because I think it's we live in the free world and we should use our freedom to fight for those who have lost theirs, and that's such rewarding work to do as well.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Fiedek, how about you? What attracts you to the documentary form?
I think that's. Documentary film is extremely powerful because imagine if you see exactly the same scene in a fiction film and in documentary film, so the documentary scene has much more impact on you than the fiction, where because watching documentary you know that it just happened in front of the camera, while watching the fiction you know that the same scene somebody has invented first and somebody has it written, somebody did rehearsals and finally somebody acted it, so this is the difference and the real power of documentary that viewers watch at them and they know that they are watching the truth.
Do you said that you've been making documentaries for the past 25 years. In that time, have you noticed as of late that the spotlight has shone a bit brighter on the documentary form, that people are flocking more to documentaries than ever before?
People more interested in documentaries.
If there are really good documentary films, then people want to watch them because my opinion, as I perceive the task of documentary filmmaker, is first of all to make a really good film, which just average people want to watch. Or then it should be clever, should touch the important topics, but first of all, it must be just a good movie to be watched by normal viewers.
Yes, sir. So let's talk a little bit about, you said that your film, The Parade, which was made 20-some years ago, gave you your first glimpse into the North Korean situation. Were you aware of these camps during that visit? And is that really when this idea to make Yoduk stories began?
You know, there are two different stories, The Parade and the Yoduk stories. The Parade I made in the year 1988. This was the last year of communist system in Poland and in my part of Europe. And so that's why we had a relatively easy access to North Korea and could make this film. Of course, you haven't seen it probably, so the film shows the North Korean totalitarian system in its purest form.
Yes.
And tell me,
Mr. Grud or Mr. Fiedek, whoever wants to answer to this. You know, you're following subjects here, people here that you know are could be endangered by taking part in a film such as this. How difficult was it to sell them on the idea of participating in this film? Tell me about that process.
We were very conscious about selecting these. These people and many of the all of the participants in the film had actually had some exposure to South Korean media before taking part in our film.
Okay.
So it really stayed away from that problem of exposing people and endangering them. But still, during the process of filming, we had an experience with Kim Jong Il's bodyguard, who withdrew from the film during the protest because he realized that his relatives in North Korea were in trouble.
Yeah, and obviously they took part in this because they want to expose the world to the conditions there, what's happening in North Korea. But at the same time, there's a scene in your film where one of your subjects gets a text message threatening his life. Were those did that scare him at all from taking part, or did that make him more determined to see this film through?
You know, these people live under terrible conditions, or they have a pressure all the time in South Korea. You know, they live in the free world, but at the same time they have agents around them all the time, and at any time they can be kidnapped back to North Korea. And by making this musical, they, you know, Yoon Sung-sun especially really exposed himself to the wrath of the North Koreans. And, he was really, really scared. And we were also scared when filming this, because we could never know, when something could happen. But, all these threats really made everyone stick together and become even more determined to put the show on and get the message out to the world.
Yeah. I definitely think it's a fantastic documentary, and I think it's a very important one as well. Tell me, you mentioned the musical. Tell me why a musical? How that idea came about?
When Thorstein Grude approached me with a proposal to work on this subject, I started to read all possible materials published by human rights organization on North Korea, and what struck me most was the phenomenon of concentration camps there, because coming back to your previous question, while shooting my film 20 years ago, of course, we just felt that it should be something like this in North Korea, because concentration camps are integral part of its totalitarian system, but we didn't know a lot about it, and now when I realize how large the scale of concentration camps phenomenon is there, we decided that our film should just concentrate on the camps. And of course it is obvious that we couldn't get there with the camera, so we were looking for an idea, and the idea came up to organize and to make a theater play about the life in concentration camp and to engage to previous concentration camps prisoners to take part in this play. So that's how the idea was born.
And as you observe them putting on this musical and performing it, did it empower them? Was it a cathartic experience for the performers to do this?
It was for the North Koreans that were putting it on. It was a unique experience for them. It was the first time many of them got together and were able to discuss, you know, their experiences from the camps, it was a dramatic process for them. You know, they relived a lot of their experiences from the North, and they incorporated, you know, all the things that they had gone through into this play.
Yeah,
it's an extremely interesting process to follow as filmmakers.
When you're, because Mr. Groot, I know that you produced it, and you also you were the cinematographers, one of the cinematographers as well. You shot the film as well. Tell me how a producer nurtures a project like this. As a producer, what are your functions? How do you get this film made?
Ah, that's a tough question.
I'm sorry.
It's a very long-term commitment. We've produced this film now it's four and a half years ago since we started. So, of course, it's a long time of fundraising and discussions with the director. You know, working with Andrzej Fidyk, you know, I think he's a genius filmmaker. So he has, you know, it's been an honor to work with him, and it's such a, you know, learning curve for me as well. To a large extent, he is, you know, very much self-motivated and self-driven. It hasn't been that hard. Although the task of, you know, putting on a musical in a completely foreign country where we don't understand the language, but all these, you know, political you know, implications and all the dangers. It's been, you know, one hell of a ride. I don't know how to answer your question really. You know, a lot of determination, I think, comes into it from all parts.
Yeah. Is there a period, I'm just curious, as a documentary filmmaker, is there a period of time that you have to spend with your subjects before they feel comfortable with the camera, where they just behave in front of the camera without thinking that it's there?
You know, so I think it's a question of experience, because if we are dealing with documentary films for years and working with people who are mostly not completely accustomed to the camera, so we got some skills which make possible for us just to open people to stop thinking about the presence of the camera and behave absolutely naturally.
Right, and you have there's such emotional moments in this film, where they're expressing such great emotion and pain, and I'm wondering as a filmmaker, if that's difficult to stay behind the camera and just observe that, because my first instinct would be to go over and comfort that person, but at the same time you know that it's important to show in your film. How do you create an environment that allows for those moments to occur?
First of all, if you are behind your camera and you see something extraordinary with big emotions going on, then you have to keep the camera on. You cannot switch it off or so, because in this case you would have to change your profession. Because if you are a documentary filmmaker, you must film what you should, what you should do. Then, afterwards, during the editing process, you can make your decisions if you want to include something into the film or not. But while something is going on, you just have to shoot it.
Yeah. You guys just had screenings at the LA Docu Week. Tell me the audience reaction to the film, and if it was everything that you hoped for.
You know, it normally when we release films, we're used to having big applause, cheers and stuff like this. But after this film, there's just dead silence in the film.
Yeah.
As a very long pause before anyone, collects themselves in order to speak, and a lot of people are crying. So it clearly really touches them. And some people have come up to us after the screening and wanted to get involved in this work for the case and donating money for the work ahead with our outreach program and stuff like that.
Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me how people can get involved.
We're gonna have we're just starting out with this production. It's just released from it just came from the laboratory, so it's very early stages. But we will have a big outreach program across America and also in Norway and Poland. We also hope to have an outreach program in South Korea, where it's really needed the most, to get information about the camps out there. But for now, the way people can get involved is to somehow help our funding. We're desperately seeking funding for the work ahead. And we do have a web page as well where people can go in and get more information about that.
Do you know that web page?
That's yodokfilm.com.
Okay.
That's www.yodokfilm.com.
Okay, I got that, Jamie.
Right. Okay, thank you, Jerry. Mr. Fiedek, I wanted to ask you a technical question about documentary filmmaking. You've been in it long enough that you have seen the video revolution come into play. Tell me the benefits of shooting documentaries in the video technology compared to film. Is it an easier process for you technically?
Each time you should adjust the means you are using to the subject and to the atmosphere and character of the film. So if the main point, main power of the film should be that there are a lot of things going on, hundreds or thousands of people in front of the camera, and you have to have the camera on all the time, otherwise you would lose something. Then, of course, in this case, it's better to use electronic camera, where the cassettes are relatively cheap and you can your camera may be on all the time. And on the other hand, if you want to achieve some special atmosphere, the cameraman wants to have a nice lighting and so on, and the quality of the picture is becoming much more important, then it's better to use that negative film, 35mm or Super 16. Of course, nowadays there are more and more modern HD cameras, which the quality of them is becoming similar to the negative. So this each time it requires a separate decision what kind of technique you would use for shooting this documentary.
Yes, sir. And you said that you're interested in, as a documentary filmmaker, you're interested in portraying human rights issues in your films. Is there a particular story, a particular region of the world that you would really like to make a film about in the future?
We are thinking about doing films in other areas where the human rights situation is particularly bad. One country that we've tried for many years is Burma, but we've been unable to find a really good way of solving it. And these days, things are going on in so many places in the world, like Georgia
yeah.
and Kurdistan.
Yeah, but I would like to add that, you know, the Yodok stories is something exceptional in my work, because, as I said it before, I perceive my main task as making a good film, films, not to fight for something. It does happen
right.
to fight for North Korea, because looking at what's going on there, you can't just be quiet. But I made a lot of films, you know, in the different countries, which were not about human rights problems, like I did, for instance, a film in India about mobile cinema there, showing the phenomenon of the Bollywood production or so. So
mm-hmm.
I'm touching different problems.
Yeah. Well, Yodok Stories is a tremendous film, and I think it's very important for people to seek it out. Are you playing additional festivals in the U.S. in the future? Do you have plans or hopes to do that?
Yes, we're certainly looking for American distribution. We hope to have a limited theatrical release. You know, we're just starting out, so our festival life is not yet planned, but, you know, it would be logical that we went to festivals like Sundance.
Yes.
And ITFA in Europe, of course.
Well, I urge our listeners to please keep tabs on the website that we've given you. For updates on this film. It's a film that demands to be seen, and I thank you both for your extraordinary work and dedication to the craft of documentary filmmaking. Hats off to you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good evening.
And you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The film is Yodok Stories, and look it up. It's, you know, it's a real eye-opener for me. I watched it earlier. Through a screener, and it's a tremendous movie and a story I didn't know what was happening.
It sounds fascinating, and I have to commend you for the interview, because I could barely hear some of them, but I really commend you. You did an awesome job there, and it sounds fascinating.
It is a fascinating movie, and you know, the point is made earlier on that he shot the parade 20 years ago, as he said. And part of that, there's a huge presentation. I don't know what you call it, when every member of a stadium, football stadium, what have you, flips these cards with images, and they form a huge mosaic.
Right, right. Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay.
It covered the entire football stadium in honor of their leaders, Kim Jong Il, and apparently they worked from dusk till dawn for 5 years to get that routine right in honor of their leader.
Wow.
And this totalitarian, yeah. And, you know, they're so good at manipulating media with propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
They're so good at propaganda that this crisis of the Hitler type concentration camps
mm-hmm.
Has gone largely hidden from view. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's famous book came out about the, I think it was 2002, about a woman who had escaped from there.
Right.
Was trying to also, and yeah, I mean, we are very ignorant about that here, but there's a large scale there are camps over there. Just,
yeah, and we hear, you know, we know about, it's been bred into us, the Nazism and the death camps in
Germany. Do you know where
Nazi
the death camps were invented? Do you know who was the first country to use it? Do you know where the concentration camp comes from?
No.
The British in the Boer War. That's where the concentration camp comes from.
Huh.
So that's the first term. I mean, but yeah, we were the Nazis are the ones who manufactured it.
Yeah.
But that's where it comes from, the Boer War.
This show's turned into a history lesson. If you turn to page 12 in your syllabus.
No, the Boer Wars were like everything is like modern. You could say modern warfare is like born. It's fascinating.
You know, and I really admire filmmakers who dedicate themselves to creating works like this, because it is, they talked about how long the process was. It does take real dedication And you really go out on a limb because it's so important to bring out these stories and share them with as many people as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, we are both people that believe that film can absolutely make a difference.
Absolutely.
In the world, that it has that power. And I don't think no genre of film more than the documentary, because just as he said, you're witnessing real life unfolding. You cannot deny it. And there's something deeply moving about that. We've had a great show tonight, and we welcome all the participants, our listeners, and our guests. Thanks to all of our listeners out there that joined us in the chat room and made great conversation during the show.
Yes, thank you so much.
thank you for choosing us.
I don't know whether to laugh or cry about that last statement, Jamie.
Yeah. Thanks, some of you, for choosing us over the convention this evening.
I didn't mind the convention. It's the other stuff that they're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us tonight. We will join you again Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, where we'll welcome our Film Composer Month has started in full swing, starting last week with Terrence Blanchard. This Sunday we have composer Andrew Lockington, who composed the Journey to the Center of the Earth 3D score, and the composer of The Clone Wars, Kevin Keener. And we're going to welcome a host of additional film composers throughout the next few weeks. And
we've got a lot of great shows coming up.
We do. You guys are gonna really like it. And I know I have 5 minutes left, but I'm closing the show a bit early. So thank you so much for joining us, everyone. We'll see you Sunday night. God bless. Have a great evening.
Good night.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.